So welcome again, listeners, to Food Conversation Season 5. Before we begin, we once again acknowledge that we are living and working on the ancestral, unceded, and essentially stolen lands of the Shkrepek people, and that fairly resolving this situation is an ongoing responsibility for us all. Today we are delighted to welcome back to the studio two energetic young women who have had a major impact both in bringing forward and reactivating Indigenous culture, but also in engaging the broader community in the Shuswap, the English word for what was always known as Shwempakulu, to help them in this work. I'm referring to Lana Payne and Sherelle Anderson, respectively, Executive Director and Program Director of Rise Up Indigenous Wellness, an Indigenous-run and directed nonprofit that runs a range of programs designed to empower Indigenous people on their path to wellness. Sherelle and Lana joined us a few weeks ago to talk about their broad range of programs, but today we've asked them to come into the studio to learn more about the background and content of their range of programs around Indigenous food security. Welcome back, Lana and Sherelle.
Thank you, Warren.
Thank you.
Delighted to have you here. Now, ladies, please, I'd like you to introduce each of you, introduce yourselves in the Indigenous way.
So my name's Sherelle Anderson. I'm a member of the Satellite Cree Nation, more specifically Goodfish Reserve. And my mother is Irene Anderson, Nee Cardinal. And my grandma is Vicky Cardinal. And my grandpa was Don Cardinal.
All right. And my name is Lana Payne, Nee Purcell. I am from the Statliam Nation, Hackshaw Band. I'm the great-granddaughter of Agnes Nelson and granddaughter of Alice Purcell.
You know, there's something about saying that you didn't just spring out of the earth fully formed, that you actually have a connection to other human beings and other generations. I just think it's wonderful. I think it's sort of saying where you're from. I mean, I'm Warren Bell, and I come from originally the Coast Salish territory in Vancouver, and on my mother's side, the Warren family was from England and unfortunately participated in a lot of very inappropriate activities like cutting down old growth forests and things of that nature. And on my father's side, my grandfather was an insurance agent who ended up at one point insuring all of the UBC grounds, but also was of Scottish and German background. So I got a bit of a mixture of Caucasian blood. Anyway, let's get back to this, today's exercise. Now, I turned up at your open house. It was delightful. Why don't you talk about your open house? It was on May the 18th, and that was your first open house?
It was our first open house. We, February, we moved into our space, and we were able to get it all set up for May 18th, and Saskew generously sponsored the event. And we just wanted to have an open afternoon, casual, where people can just come in and see our space and see what we were all about. And it was fairly well attended.
What was it like for you, Lana? There was this culmination of a lot of work that you've been putting in over the last while.
Yeah, no, it was a good opportunity for us to connect with other social organizations in the community, as well as just people who were interested in what we were doing and what was going on, and good chance just to build that bridge of understanding.
And what kind of representatives, which kinds of groups turned up?
We had people from the Family Resource Center, Canada Mental Health Association,
Saskew, the Salmon Arm Economic Development was there, and then just like our regular population of Salmon Arm. I don't know what the right word is,
right?
Yeah,
your
yeah.
Regular fans are there as well.
Urban Indigenous people.
Yeah.
Now, speaking of community support, I found an article in the Salmon Arm Observer on the day you guys picked up a van from Bravey Motors. Now that was because of a grant you got from the Gaming Association.
That's right.
What was that like? You actually had a vehicle that you could really throw a lot of stuff into.
Well, I think it was really like when we seen the grant come out, the capital grant, Lana was like, we should apply for it. It gives us some
some autonomy.
Yeah, exactly. and it was just, we were surprised when we got the grant, I think, and then just so grateful. And it just has really helped us be able to transport kids to camps and also to deliver food. So it was a needed item.
Lana, you were surprised?
I was optimistic throughout the process, but we were very early on in our process of being a small nonprofit. And it was something that took us to the next level. Once we had transportation, we were able to do a lot more programming. So, yeah, I was happily surprised.
And you said to the reporter, said, our programming includes providing opportunities for young people and their families to connect with teachings on the land. And this often requires transporting people to site. So it actually resulted in you being able to really implement your programs more easily and more successfully.
Definitely. Prior to that, we were having to rely on volunteers to help us with transporting young people and families or do double trips. So it really made a big difference. We've grown so much that we're almost in that position again where it's difficult to get everybody where we need them to be and to transport.
So my next question is, who does the driving?
We both do.
Well, driving is fun when you've got a purpose. But you've received support actually from all sorts of organizations, and I just mentioned a couple of them. Probably a lot of people know about the Shuswap Community Foundation. Was that a grant that you were able to get from them?
Yeah, they actually they funded a partial for the van, and they've helped us out as well with camps too.
That's lovely. So there's a group that some listeners may not be familiar with. It's called the Indigenous Sport, Physical Activity and Recreation Council, or ISPARC. Why don't you tell listeners about that?
Oh, ISPARC is an organization that funds a lot of physical activity programs for Indigenous people. So some of our physical activity groups and our camps were rewarded with funding through ISPARC, including our on-the-land camps.
That's probably a good idea, because I see pictures showing you guys wandering around in the bush, and you need to have some recognition that it's a lot of physical activity too. The government of British Columbia has helped out a little bit here and there. What kind of help has it given, Cheryl?
So they gave us the capital purchase, like the other portion for the van, and then they've also gave us some money for our programming.
Well, the list goes on. The First Peoples Cultural Council. Now, Lana, that sounds like it's right up your alley.
First Peoples Cultural Council, we had a successful grant from them focusing on culture and youth activity and mentorship. So we have a variety of programs around incorporating culture into on-the-land teachings. Like, we recently did a drum-making workshop with some young men. We had a girls' retreat about a week ago, and a variety of other groups and activities that happened throughout the last couple seasons.
A lot of people involved. Now, listeners probably are familiar with the Shuswap Coffee Company and the Church's Thrift Shop and the CMHA. All have helped you out as well. But you also reached out eastwards to Revelstoke and had some support from Community Connections in Revelstoke in the eastern part of Shkwepukulu. What was that all about?
So that we were able to connect with them through our connection with CMHA originally, and then Community Connections has hired us on to do on-the-land camps with the children, and the urban Indigenous children in Revelstoke as well. And we also are able to do some mom and baby workshops through the Indigenous Friendship Society in Revelstoke too.
Why don't you tell listeners a bit about a mom and baby workshop?
Oh yeah. So we started with like welcoming baby, and we just talked about different traditions around the world and Indigenous culture of how you welcome the baby into this side of the world.
Right.
And then we did some Indigenous wellness workshop where we looked at balancing our wheel, like our medicine wheel, and where we may be a little bit off balance in one area.
So, Lana, what is that process and the underlying principle behind it, the balancing the wheel?
So it's really looking at health holistically, so that you have a physical piece to yourself, an emotional piece, a mental piece, and a spiritual piece, and looking at the ways that you're taking care of yourself in each of those four areas. So for our moms who were either pregnant or just had their babies, oftentimes they're neglecting some of their self-care. So we were trying to support them through that piece. And another portion of that program was decolonizing baby food. So we had
Let's talk about decolonizing baby food.
Let's go there.
Let's go there. Shrell, how do you decolonize baby food?
Well, we wanted to get food that was native to this area, or to Canada at least. And so what we did was we cooked up some elk meat. We cooked up salmon, wild rice, blueberries. And so I think we mixed the salmon with
the salmon and berries, the blueberries and blackberries.
Yeah.
And then the mamutin or wild rice with the elk. And then we did also some salmon and rice as well.
Yeah.
So they're for babies like 5 months and up, not
yeah.
for
Well,
newborns.
I don't think of myself as a baby, but I'm getting hungry.
You would like
I'm
that.
Hungry.
The adults were eating it.
Sorry, my dear baby. I'm busy right now. So a lot of your programs center around food, and that's natural because it's such a way to join people together. So I'll just rattle them off. Cook with our kids, plant medicine, emergency food hamper program, and food preservation workshop. So let's get a little bit into the weeds, as they say, although I like to think of weeds as hardy native perennials. Not really. They're not bad. So cook with our kids. What's that about, Lana?
So that's a program where the moms and kids come together. Often we're preparing part of the meal together. So say we're having a take home, like a taco meal or something, where we'll maybe make homemade salsa together. And then the families have the rest of the ingredients to take home with them. And they make the meal at home with their kids. So part of at the gathering, usually we have something lined up for the kids to do, and the moms come together and visit and prepare some of that portion of the meal so that we can connect, and then they go home and cook.
It sounds like something that I think Indigenous people have to teach the settler community, the non-Indigenous community, and that's to have some fun while you're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine the kids being there and not, you know, enjoying what they're doing, and the moms are enjoying what they're doing, and you're having a good time teaching them.
No, it yeah. definitely, yeah, it is. It's a lot of fun, lots of laughter.
It creates community.
Well, that's a very good thing
yeah.
to do. So how old are the kids in this program?
We don't really exclude, like, we're trying to be pretty
but
open.
But they're not teenagers.
Sometimes we have teenagers come
yeah.
to things. So we're really open with it, from
sure.
yeah.
little ones to older ones, to whoever wants to be, you know, whoever comes
sure.
along.
Yeah.
And you're obviously embracing food from other cultural sources. You said tacos and
oh, yeah.
salsa and stuff like that. I'd like to remind listeners that we're talking today with Lana Payne and Sherelle Anderson, who are respectively the executive director and program director of Rise Up Indigenous Wellness. You know, it's an interesting illusion that people have about the Indigenous world, that somehow you won't have anything to do with other cultures, modern culture. You know, everybody's got to be wearing loincloths and running around, you know, with moccasins on. But that's really a completely false impression, isn't it, Lana?
Yes, and that whole idea of, like, decolonizing our diet really means eating more natural and eating from the land. So
right.
if it's salsa from things that we've grown nearby here or that have been grown here, it connects to our teaching. And I've heard it said that our elders say we're so connected to the land because the food that we've eaten from the land here, our ancestors have eaten from time immemorial. So us, we're part of this land because of that food that goes in our bodies.
And what you're doing is you're extending that notion of eating from the land around you to eating from the land, whatever it happens to grow that Mother Nature puts there, or that we humans put there.
Yeah.
And add, yeah. It's an important thing for people to understand. I remember hearing of a full-blooded Sioux woman who went to a reenactment camp in Germany where German people of Caucasian background were running around in loincloths and wearing feathers in their hair and all this kind of stuff. And she came in with spandex pants and a cell phone and said, "Hi, I just want to see what you guys are doing." And they were actually offended. They said, "Why aren't you dressed, you know, the way an indigenous person would dress, which is ridiculous. Why would you not wear other clothes if they were available?" I think that's something that...
Yeah, and I do think, like, along those same lines, like, it's a misconception that we can only decolonize our diet through harvesting and fishing and hunting, that we can't still have a healthy decolonized diet with shopping at farmers markets and like, making those food choices that are not processed foods, like, in general, and changing from a more sedentary lifestyle back to a more active lifestyle.
It's very interesting that the word localization or relocalization is a big, long word that is sort of saying the same thing that is sort of a natural part of an indigenous worldview. It doesn't mean you don't buy ulakan from the coast. It means that you grow a lot of your own food and you need to have food in your immediate area because if it's a bad winter, you know, you can't avoid it. So we've got the kids fed. Let's move on to medicines, plant medicine workshops. How are those constructed, Cheryl?
I think they're worked into our camp. So we have one of our colleagues that we bring in. She knows a lot about the local plant medicine. So she teaches the kids and the women in our workshops the different uses for our local plants and how it can help you with, like, alleviate pain and also teas you can make from the local plants.
So do you guys try them out?
Yeah. She brings it and teaches the kids. Yeah.
And we often bring teas to our gatherings with other organizations so that they can have a taste of traditional tea.
Yes, you gave me some at your workshop. And I'm sitting on my counter, and I've had some already.
Very nice.
And I feel much better.
Okay.
And I like when we're thinking about medicines from the land and the idea that we have a cultural way of, if we're gathering, like, doing things in a good and right way. And I heard someone speaking recently about that idea that we pray or give thanks for our food to be medicine for us, to nourish us. Mm-hmm. And we wouldn't be praying with a bag of chips or a bottle of pop because there's no nourishment and medicine there. So it becomes an actual reminder to choose food that's medicine for you.
You know, it's fascinating because that the person who's called the father of Western medicine, Hippocrates, said, "Let your food be your medicine and your medicine be your food." He could have come over here and he would have just, well, that's what we talk about all the time. But he was in Greece, so couldn't get tickets to come over.
He had that good Greek food.
Yes, indeed, there's some good Greek food, absolutely. There's good food all over the world. Now, you also prepare emergency food hampers for people who are in need. How does that work?
If somebody's referred to us and if they're struggling, we can help them out. It's just, if it's an emergency, they can give us a call and we're happy.
And how does that work? How do you get the food and what kind of food do you look for or obtain?
Well, in those situations, we do like to give grocery cards because we think you're capable. You know what you need,
sure.
Right?
Yes.
But then with our other food hampers, our ongoing food hampers, we try to make sure it's healthy, nutritious foods. We don't include processed foods. We try to avoid canned foods unless we've canned them, like, freshly or canned them ourselves. And we just try to make sure that there's a variety of healthy foods, fresh, you know, local. We buy meat from grillers in town here. We get our produce often from
DeMills.
And DeMills.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Lon, it sounds like your this process of preparing food and distributing food, from what I've heard, is it's fairly, I wouldn't say costly, but it requires work and it requires, you know, some financial investment. How many people are you able to help out this way? I'm sure it varies from time to time.
So we have a regular amount of hampers of about 12 families, 12 to 14 a month, which it varies from month to month, but we would love to help more. And sometimes there's an emergency call, like we get referrals from other places where we will come up with extra, but it's just based on our funding. That's the only amount that we're able to help at this time.
Cheryl, how widespread is the knowledge of your program in the Indigenous community overall? I know that your reach out are involved with many different Indigenous communities and groups, but how widespread is the understanding that you're there?
Well, I think our word is starting to get out more, and especially with having our space now, like we're visible, and just making more segues, like through media and through radio talk shows.
Radio talk shows.
Yeah.
I've never
like,
heard of them.
The word's getting out more. And we have collaborations too. Like we've worked with Serena with the Food Action Society. So it's growing.
Why don't you, speaking of that, why don't you describe the precise location of your new habitation, your new, what do you call it? Your office or your
space?
Yeah. Okay. We call it a center usually because it's more than an office. It's, sure. We run groups there.
Yeah.
So what's the exact location?
875 Lakeshore Drive. So we're like, you can see us from the highway and we're right by the Petrocan.
You're west, sort of in the western side, yeah, of the town. In that, I think there's,
yeah,
a name.
Village West.
Village
Development.
West, yes. That's right. Mm-hmm. Yes. And did you have to do quite a bit of work to set the place up? Was it something that you had to shape into the kind of place you wanted it to be?
I think so.
Yeah, like we really wanted it to feel inviting and like an Indigenous welcoming space.
You have some soft chairs to sit in. That's inviting right there.
We've pieced together well, considering a lot of our things came from the thrift store.
Okay.
But I think we were really flattered to hear from people who have come since we've been in there that the space feels welcoming and inviting and they want to stay. And that was what we were going for, is somewhere where people want to relax and chat and make food and be together.
And do you have somebody there most of the time? Is it, do you have hours at the center?
I'm at this point, because we just received funding to hire somebody else half time, we're kind of the everything, running all the programs. So if we're running programs, we're not there. In the fall, where we'll have posted hours and things will be a bit more regular, having extra staff.
Growing pains.
Yes.
They call that growing pains. Now, one part of what you do, which I think intersects with a lot of the other parts, is workshops on food preservation. Because obviously, if you're trying to share food that's preserved and stable, and you're making a point of having it the right kind of food, you'd have to make some of that yourselves. So, Cheryl, describe a typical food preservation workshop.
So we just did asparagus because it's in season now, and so we were able to can 46 jars of asparagus, and so then we'll be able to give those out to families in our hampers. And I guess the next one will be strawberries, and we're thinking we'll cut them and freeze them and seal them, so like you can have fresh strawberries, and then strawberry jam as well. So we're just going to keep going with what's coming out.
So it's very much seasonal?
Yes, yes.
Of course, which is the obvious thing to do. Where do you do the workshops and your own work to do preserving?
Zest, we just are partnered, or yes, we're able to use their kitchens, which is great because now we have a commercial kitchen
we can use. That's right, the Zest Hub. I remember when it was being planned and then implemented, it really was a lift to a lot of small-scale production. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not doing huge volume, you're doing something local for local folks, as they say. How are you one of what they call their anchor tenants, or you just use it when you've got stuff?
Oh, just when we got stuff, not an anchor tenant.
They're very well equipped with all sorts of gear.
Oh yeah, you don't need anything.
And we knew that last time. We could smell bread baking and chocolate being made. Like, this is too much.
So once in a while you say, I think we should go over and do a little food preserving.
Yeah, exactly.
And bring our noses along with us. Now we're going to talk a little bit about some new programs that you've got set up, but maybe the point would be to talk about why they've been set up. You have two new programs, one for males, young males, and another one for young females. And the male program is called Peaceful Warriors, and I think there's a hint of what it's all about in the title. And We Are Sacred is the title the description for the program for young girls. Now, it's interesting, Mary Thomas, there's some recordings of Mary Thomas that we play regularly on the station here, and she has talked about some of the protocols and procedures and rites that were used for, I particularly remember the one for young women, which would involve going alone out into the bush. Your only contact would be your grandmother, I believe, and you'd go through a variety of different processes to sort of acquaint you with your own body, to acquaint you with the natural world. How let's start there. How does the We Are Sacred program work?
So we will be starting that in the fall, and what it is, it's what we're doing is working from an upstream model to address the murdered and missing Indigenous women and girls. So we're developing this program to connect girls to culture, to community, so that they have a safe place and no boundaries. And if, when they get older, if they're in unsafe situations, they hopefully we'll have that knowledge and strength to step away from it.
Do you do it out on the land, or do you do it in sort of...
It'll be out on the land.
And parts.
Parts, yeah.
Yeah, like a combination. And that idea that culture is medicine too. Like, a part of our wellness is connecting deeply with our culture to heal.
So how do you, Lana, how do you blend these two issues? The issue of safety in the larger non-Indigenous community and in Indigenous communities as well, but also the teaching about being sacred, about your body being a sacred space. It's like two sides of the coin. One is risk and danger, and the other is celebration and appreciation.
Well, we really believe that connecting with culture creates empowerment in our young girls. So it's a piece that that our people have had to rediscover because of colonization. So stepping back and being reminded of the sacredness of us as life givers and as women, and starting with our girls in preparing their shoulders to hold that weight is a big piece of We Are Sacred, to prepare them to be strong, strong and powerful Indigenous women.
I'd like to remind listeners that we're talking today with Lana Payne and Sherelle Anderson, who are respectively the Executive Director and Program Director of Rise Up Indigenous Wellness. It seems to me this ties in directly with what you're trying to accomplish with Rise Up Indigenous Wellness, the organization, which is to redirect attention away from all the statistics about, you know, health issues on reserves and within the Indigenous community broadly, and focus instead on the resilience, the power, the strength, the fact that Indigenous culture, despite very significant efforts to eliminate or, you know, modify it drastically, has been kept alive and very much alive. Sherelle, what do you think about that?
No, I think that's exactly what Rise Up is it, we're focusing on our resilience and just like the power of Indigenous culture, and that we can bring everybody up, like nobody's left behind.
And what kind of response do you get when you bring this? It's not really a teaching, it's just an approach, or it's an awareness, whatever you want to call it. when you bring it into, in a very formal way, as a formal organization, you know, you've got a title and a name and people involved with it, the two of you, what kind of response do you get from within Indigenous communities?
Oh, overall, very, like, it's well received, and people are, I think, just happy that there's like a kind of a space or a center that where we can gather and just be who you are, and there's no preconceived notions of what Indigenous should look like.
Lana, do you have different responses from different generations within Indigenous communities? Do you find that older people react differently from young people, or what?
I think our elders are like very happy to see the resurgence of culture. Not that it's been lost, but that it's been put aside, and that that it's coming back to the mainstream. And we've seen with some of the programs we've done, elders kind of involved or on the periphery, wanting to be more involved and wanting to be a part of that. And I think it really keeps with our traditional model of intergenerational mentorship, and like having the elders and the teens and the young people and adults all together and sharing their knowledge from their very different perspectives.
Sherelle, did you find that some people were nervous or anxious about participating? You know, that we're going to... I know that, for just to explain what I'm getting at, one of the hosts on this show, on the station here, talked about growing up in a small town in the foothills of the Rockies, and he said everybody from all over the world lived there. The people who were different were Indigenous people, because they kept their heads down. They didn't make eye contact. They were really suppressed. Do you see any of that when you're moving out and sharing your programs and what you're trying to accomplish?
Like, I don't think with our programming so much. It's and lots of our programming is smaller groups, too. It's not huge community events yet. So I hope we're creating a safe space where people don't have to feel like they...
Well, if they're not responding that way, then you must be.
Yeah. And I think because our population is urban Indigenous, for some families there have been a disconnect from culture, just from their physical proximity away from their reserves or bands or what have you. So for some families, it's almost... for the young people, a relearning of what the culture is. And there's a lot of excitement around that. But to what you were saying earlier, like I think about, I grew up in Revelstoke. And when I was young, there was very few Indigenous people who lived in Revelstoke. And that, there were misconceptions around Indigenous culture, I would say, at that time, being a little older than my partner here.
Just a little. Well, I guess you haven't actually implemented the programs yet. They're planned for this fall.
That's right, yeah.
Do you have a sense that there's going to be a bit of a different response from what you know about what you've been doing so far in these other programs related to food? Do you have a sense that there will be a different response from young boys and teen boys versus young girls and teen girls?
Well, with the boys group, we're going to have males lead it. So I think it'll be different in the fact that Lana and I won't be leading it. So we're hoping that there will be a stronger connection by having stronger male Indigenous role models.
So how do you go about recruiting male teachers for boys group on the values of males within the Indigenous culture, Lana?
Well, there really is a lot of advocates out there, people who do want to be involved. It's just hard because it's part-time. It's not something that we can get somebody in full-time doing. So we've been accumulating a list. We have been, as a precursor to all this, we have been doing boys and girls programming, but the official, our work with the Building Safer Communities program with the City of Salmon Arm officially starts in the fall. So we've been building up to it with some of our other programming. And yeah, I think, like, to mirror what Sherelle said, the boys having men as our guides and mentors will be very powerful.
the Building Safer Communities program, what was it that you got, that you said to them that got them involved, Sherelle?
I think it was presenting that the issue of domestic violence and murdered and missing Indigenous women, and that we, if we work from an upstream model, hopefully we can help with that problem, that major issue.
Sure, yeah, sure, it is a major issue.
Because the grant itself, the funding for Building Safer Communities, was a national fund that Salmon Arm happened to be able to apply for, and it was for gang and gun violence reduction. So because Salmon Arm is a cross-through community between Vancouver and Kelowna and near Kamloops too, it was seen as at risk. So we were, and the higher at-risk community is Indigenous people.
Just stepping back from this a little bit, and talking about food and its relationship to security and connecting culturally, how does an Indigenous approach to food, just in general, play into building community? Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it does. Because you, if we think like traditionally, you would live in a community of Indigenous people, and the food that was brought there was for everybody. And if we bring that to modern day, that's how we want to run our groups, is the food is for everybody. Nobody goes hungry, and you'll have something to take home too.
Fundamental principle there is sharing. You don't keep it for yourself. Lana, do you have anything to add to that? I think it's such a fundamental concept that a lot of people in the non-Indigenous community have passed right by. It's, you know, get for yourself, get as much as you can. The so-called capitalist system means you accumulate more for yourself. That's good.
I really think, you know, our traditional teachings see it as a redistribution of wealth. So the food is the wealth, and sharing it equally throughout everybody makes us all richer for it. So our gatherings were one way, and one way that we still share food. We've recently been to a couple non-Indigenous gatherings where we were surprised that people don't take all the leftover food home with them. We usually show up with containers, and at our gatherings, we bring empty containers for everyone. The food is there. We eat together. Everybody takes some home.
Well, I'm so glad I came to your open house. And, and you shared with me very generously. I ate it mostly by the time I got to Merritt. It was that good.
Road snacks.
What we're talking about is sort of a shift in cultural values with food as a means to penetrate through some of the resistance to make those kinds of changes. How do you find the broader community? Well, let's talk about your focus is on urban Indigenous folks. What about people who are still living on reserves and therefore have their own sort of some degree of support system? What kind of interaction have you had with established reserve structures and people?
Sure. Oh, we with our food hampers, there've been months where we've given 5 to 7 hampers to the bands, and they can just distribute it how they want.
So you're not, although your focus is urban Indigenous, it's not exclusive. And how is that byplay between urban and reserve-based? Lana, what about that? It's fairly fluid, is it?
Yeah, so we don't want to be exclusionary by any means. So we do work on reserves. The local bands have contracted us for a number of different things. And whether we're running camps or doing workshops, food is a part of that, because that's in our culture. Food is a part of everything. And it's a medicine and a wellness. And then with our help and hampers, we trust that the people reaching out are asking for what they need. So it's like shifting and removing any guilt or expectation, and just saying, we trust that you are taking what you need.
And you don't have to fill out a 3-page form to prove that you are a legitimate recipient of some food.
None of that. No. And it's the same idea. Some funders are reluctant to fund for grocery cards or gas cards. And yet we find when people are in crisis, we want to trust that you'll get what you need and you'll have some gas money to get there if that's a requirement.
Yeah, that issue of trust. I notice that in your introduction to the organization, you make a point of saying we provide Indigenous programs by Indigenous facilitators for Indigenous participants. Our board of directors is 100% Indigenous and includes two elders. I mean, you couldn't say much more clearly that you're wanting to reassure people that there's no sort of, you're not filtering through a kind of non-Indigenous system, bureaucracy, focus, whatever you might call it. Is that something that matters to the people that you're working with, Sherelle?
I think so. And I just think...
Whether you actually say it or not.
Yeah. And it matters to our organization because the urban Indigenous population is who we are representing. And we want to assure that, we're Indigenous and it's not a non-Indigenous person coming in with their worldviews, and it's time that Indigenous people have their worldview seat as well.
Can you tell from the way people respond to your programs that is really an important thing for them?
Yeah, because they know that we have knowledge and that we are so open to having other Indigenous people share their knowledge as well. Like, it's not just Lana and I. It's like, we're learning from the kids. We're learning from the parents. It's like, it really is a community. It's a circle. It's not top down.
Do you think the fact that you're women gives you a different kind of insight into the sort of sharing, nurturing perspective, Lana?
Yeah, well, I think to add to what Sherelle said, it really, we're removing barriers by reassuring everyone that it's Indigenous programming for Indigenous participants. So removing that barrier and also, not ticking boxes or making lists or anything like that. That's all just about openly sharing.
I'd like to remind listeners that we're talking today with Lana Payne and Sherelle Anderson, who are respectively the Executive Director and Program Director of Rise Up Indigenous Wellness. I have a number of Indigenous patients in my practice, and there's always this sense that if you're dealing with someone in the non-Indigenous community, they're either going to not understand what your priorities are or dismiss some of the issues that you're dealing with as a person seeking help with their health. And when I see all those repetitions of the word Indigenous, I have a sense that you're aware of that fact, that when people come to you, they want to know that you will not just speak the physical language, but speak the kind of perspective that makes sense to them and that they can feel safe. Safety and trust sort of go hand in hand. You can't feel safe if you don't trust the person that you're working with. So that's what I'm getting at, and that's what you were talking about.
Yeah, no, absolutely, that speaks to what we're doing. And also, outside of our regular programming, we've been expanding into decolonizing stereotypes and myths and Indigenous wellness into non-Indigenous organizations, because there's a need for it in the community, and it's important for us to represent Indigenous culture in a holistic understanding kind of way as part of reconciliation. So when you talk about staff or organizations or people struggling with systemic barriers, part of our work is to go out and do some of those workshops in order to fund the grassroots part of our programming.
Now, we should probably talk a little bit about, when we're talking about food, who makes the rules about food in the organization, because you have a board of directors which contains two, and we're talking about age, we can say that they are from a previous generation and they probably have a lot of knowledge and ideas about food. Where did you guys learn something about preparing food?
I would say, well, one is Donna on our board.
And who is Donna? We Donna, want to know who Donna is.
Donna is also my mother. And
which
I Donna, to, Donna Beaumont. She's,
I just want to say that's wonderful. You know, it doesn't matter that she's your mother. In non-Indigenous society, people get all excited and say, well, that's, you know, that's favoritism, that's nepotism, or whatever all these words are. But in fact, it's respect for somebody who's older than you and has a lot of experience. That's the basis of it.
Absolutely. And in an Indigenous way of looking at things, like working with your community and family is extremely important. So my mom has always done food based activities. She's catered over the years. She canned. So recently my uncle dip netted a good amount of salmon that he provides us with every year from the Fraser River. And just we had some frozen still, about 10, that she smoked last week for a couple events that we have upcoming.
Shrill.
So my mom is also on the board, Irene. And like my whole life, her and my grandma would can. And she thinks it's a great skill that's getting lost. And she wanted to make sure I knew how to can. And then Lana and I just wanted to make sure that we could pass that knowledge on to people as well if they were unsure of how to do it.
So how much do these elders of yours participate in the work you do?
Oh, like any events we have, they're invited to. They don't make it to all of them, that's for sure. But
do they participate in the actual teaching stuff?
Or so they just sort of food things.
Yeah, with the food, yeah.
Yes, that's what I mean.
Yeah, neither one of them are cultural instructors, I guess. Mm-hmm. Although they both have lots of knowledge. But when it comes to helping out behind the scenes, like smoking salmon or sourcing out some things we need, they're both very active with that.
Let's talk a little bit about connecting outside the Indigenous community in the broader community. You've got very concrete and specific support for a lot of things that you're doing. What kind of attitudinal support are you sensing?
Well, actually, just yesterday we had a big group meeting with a lot of stakeholders and people in Salmon Arm community around ways that we can become more sustainable, because right now Rise Up runs grant to grant, and it's hard to have an annual plan or a 2-year plan when you just have 1-year grants. So we had a meeting to discuss different ways and avenues that we could become more sustainable, so that we're not just a finite program that ends when we run out of grant funding.
That's a problem, Sherelle. The radio station has the same problem. Mm-hmm. We run from grant to grant. What do you hope to be able to achieve in terms of sustainable funding?
Well, I for Rise Up, we want to be able to have programming, consistent programming that we can offer and be this is when we offer this programming, mm-hmm. and have staff that we can have more staff than Lana and I. And yeah.
What's that like, having just the two of you doing so much work? Running around like wild things.
We've become Jill of all trades.
Well, and the other thing is, and our friend Sarah with the city pointed it out, it's not only not sustainable for us to be doing everything. If something happened or one of us had to step aside, it's unlikely that someone else would have as much vested interest in spending evenings and weekends and all that extra time that it takes when something's a passion project for you. So essentially, creating some sustainability will ensure the longevity of our programming after we're gone.
What kind of response are you getting that tells you whether or if or that this kind of response is available? That the people are starting to say, I have a passion for this. I think this is great. I want to do it too.
Yeah, and the support of the community in general, all pretty much we've felt supported by all the local organizations. We get referrals from them. They're standing up and coming to our events and tables and saying, oh, we want to make sure that your programming continues to carry on and exist.
Sherelle, how do you feel exhausted sometimes?
Well, I love what we're doing, but there was a few weeks there where it was really late nights. But you know what? Who else is going to do it? That's what it comes down to. And we have to get it. We have to get this off the ground. So
are people slowly starting, now that they recognize you're there, are they starting to come forward? And when you reach out, you get a response more than you might have got, say, a year or two ago?
Oh, I think so for sure. And I think just having our center is putting our place on the map. Is that the right word?
Landed.
Yes.
You're attached to the land over there in Village West.
Yeah, 875.
Yes, 875 for all listeners. I think it is important because there are a lot of changes taking place in society, and you're wearing a t-shirt that says feminist, a person who believes in equality for all genders, and maybe you could apply that to many aspects of human existence. All genders, all cultures, all languages, all sizes, all, you know, colors, all, you name it. It's a process that many people feel we have to go through. We have to go through if we're going to survive as a human enterprise on the planet. Do you guys ever, when you've had a long day at work and you're sort of feeling, I think I need some sleep or I need some rest, do you ever think in those sort of broader terms, do you ever feel that you really are part of a very important human enterprise that includes everybody, Lana?
Yeah, I feel like we often come back and talk about what we're doing and reflect after and say, you know, it's important work. It's important to bridge that gap and create understanding and between cultures and by modeling, like even our work with the immigrant society and working around new Canadians, and we're planning some workshop training for new Canadians to understand Indigenous people on a different level too.
Interesting how the blending of cultures often brings up the same issues, no matter which culture it is and how you're trying to blend in that particular situation. I want to thank you both for coming again. It's been, as it was the first time, a lot of fun, but also I think a lot of good talk about things that matter. These are things, I would agree with you that what you're doing is really important work. It's bringing a perspective that connects everyone needs to be connected to the land, but the non-Indigenous culture has kind of forgotten that and needs to be retrained. And what you're doing, I think, is the kind of work that really makes that happen. So thank you both for coming here, and thank you for the work you do.
Thank you for having us, Warren.